Looking at us. Good afternoon, everyone. Is the mic working? Can you hear me in the back? Testing, testing. Welcome, everyone. Good afternoon, or is it good evening? At this time of year, one's never quite sure what to say at 6 or 5 o'clock at night. I'm Fred Donner. I'm the director of the Center for Middle Eastern Studies. It's a pleasure to welcome you all to this year's Talat and Isabel Othman Lecture, sponsored by the Center for Middle Eastern Studies. We're deeply grateful to the Othmans for making this annual event possible through their generous endowment. We really appreciate it very much. And we're very pleased that Talat Othman himself can be here today. It's a real pleasure to introduce this year's speaker, Professor Roger Owen, who is the A.G. Meyer Professor of Middle Eastern History at Harvard University. And his title will be, when he gets to it in a few minutes after my introduction, Egypt and Revolution, When All Is Politics and Few Think Seriously About the Parlous State of the Economy. Roger Owen was trained at Oxford, among other places, took his DPhil in economic history from St. Anthony's College in Oxford in 1964. And then proceeded to start teaching at Oxford in 64 as lecturer in the recent economic history of the Middle East. He taught there from 1964 to 1993 in that position. During that time, he was not once, not twice, not thrice, but four times director of the famous Middle East Center at St. Anthony's College. That's been a very productive center for leading research on Middle Eastern studies, Middle Eastern history, and so on for decades. And so he was four times director of that. And during that time, he was also at various points visiting professor at the American University in Cairo in 1975, at University of California, Berkeley, 1982, University of Texas at Austin, 1990. And then in 1993, he moved to Harvard to become the A.G. Meyer Professor of Middle Eastern History. And there, too, at Harvard, he also served a term as director of their Center for Middle Eastern Studies. So he has a lot of experience in that field. He also has received an honorary doctorate, a doctorate in humane letters from the American University of Cairo in 2007. Roger Owen's many publications have explored the economic history of the Arab world over the last two centuries. And really, I think we can say he and his work have created the field of modern Middle Eastern economic history. I think when he entered it, there were very, very few people who, well, there weren't that many people doing Middle Eastern history anyway, of any kind, but particularly economic history was underdeveloped, and in some ways it has remained underdeveloped. This is why there is actually a book awarded, I think, every 2 years by the Middle East Studies Association called the Roger Owen Book Award for the best book in the previous 2 years on the subject of the Middle East, the economic history of the Middle East. The goal in establishing that award was, in Roger's honor, was to encourage scholars to work on the economic history of the region. And he has, as you might imagine, a tremendous list of publications, five important books. The first of them, quite a famous book, Cotton and the Egyptian Economy, 1820 to 1914, A Study in Trade and Development, appeared in 1969. He also wrote The Middle East and the World Economy, 1800 to 1914, a kind of an overview. State Power and Politics in the Making of the Modern Middle East, published 1992. Lord Cromer, Victorian Imperialist, Edwardian Proconsul, published in 2004. And most recently, a book that I haven't read yet, but I really look forward to reading, The Rise and Fall of Arab Presidents for Life, in 2012. In addition to these five books, he's also co-edited no fewer than 11 volumes of papers and essays. As I say, sometimes co-edited, and I'm going to unfairly to them leave out the names of the co-editors so I can get finished with this. One is History of the Middle East of the Middle East Economies in the 20th Century, one called Studies in the Theory of Imperialism, one Essays on the Crisis in Lebanon, published in 1976 just as the Lebanese Civil War was beginning. I remember reading it with great interest when it came out. one on the Islamic world in the 18th century, studies in the economic and social history of Palestine in the 19th and 20th centuries, the sociology of developing societies, Middle East, Suez, 1956, the crisis and its consequences, Egypt under Mubarak, the languages of history, selected writings on the Middle East, new perspectives on property and land in the Middle East, the revolutionary Middle East in 1958. This gives you some idea of the tremendous range of his work within the field of economic history, both in time and in space. And you get a better idea, even if I just read a few titles from the many reports he's written of various kinds and articles for journals and collected volumes that he's contributed to. I'll just read a few titles: Labor Migration in the Gulf, The Cairo Building Industry and the Building Boom of 1897 to 1907, The Ideology of Egyptian Nationalism in its Egyptian Context, 1919 to 39, The Arab Oil Economy, Its Structure and Prospects, published in 1985, The Economic History of Lebanon, Its Salient Features, 1943 to 74, The Middle Eastern Factory as a Site for New Technology, Class and Class Politics in, I think it should be Iraq before 1958. It says Iran here, but I think it should be Iraq, right? The Lebanese Silk Industry, 1840 to 1914. Settler Colonization in the Middle East and North Africa, its economic rationale. The Influence of Lord Cromer's Indian Experience on British Policy in Egypt, 1883 to 1907. Well, it gives you an idea of the range of his interests and abilities. Really someone who has, as they say, virtually created a field. So it's with great pleasure that I welcome you here, Roger, and please join me in welcoming Roger Owen.
Hello, thank you all for coming. Of course, introductions like, oh, yes, my stick always falls over the minute.
I can use this to keep the audience.
Yeah, well, that's right, yes. I have another stick, which makes me look like an Egyptian omda, which I menace people with more. Introductions like this make me feel very old, and I can't remember writing any of these books, which is quite interesting. I know that it was typewritten, and it was quite hard to type. I mean, none of you know what a typewriter is, young people, anymore, but... We typed away, and we had copies, and we had some whiting fluid, which got all over us, the desk, what I call my trousers and so on. So it makes me feel very old. But also, one of the nice things about teaching is you can imagine yourself to be young. I've always imagined that the faces that I see are mirrors to my own face. It's a great shock when I look in the mirror sometimes, when I'm shaving in the morning. Sometimes I see my mother's face. Who did I see last time? A famous German of the 19th century. Anyway, it's don't get old if you can avoid it. All right, all by way of complicated introduction. And now to my subject, Egypt in Revolution, when all is political and few think seriously about the parlous state of the economy. And I want to begin by talking about paradox. Lord Cromer referred to Egypt as the land of paradox, but he was only taking after Herodotus, who had visited Egypt as a part of his travels around the ancient world, and came and decided that it was a strange and paradoxical place, because it was well known that all rivers flowed from north to south, whereas the Nile flowed from south to north, and everything seemed to be backwards and so on. That's a bit of an Orientalist notion at the moment, that the Egyptians are paradoxical and strange and upside down. But there is a paradox about Egypt, which I want to explore, which is the way in which, in a political revolution, which is partly brought upon by the parlous state of the economy or worries about the economy, while the revolution is on, its talk is all of politics. But in the background, there is always a sense that Egypt is in a dire economic situation and something needs to be done about that. And I want to talk about something, to do this in a form that I learned from my mentor, Professor A.J. Meyer, whose who's my professorship at Harvard is named after, who whenever he talked had something called a good news scenario, a good news, bad news scenario, that in any situation there were always five reasons for optimism and five reasons for pessimism, which might stand you in good stead in life, but because you're always right, but you're always wrong about something or other. But I'll try and use that to illustrate the paradox of a revolution that is a political revolution in a country which is both economically in economically desperate straits, but also contains people who know perfectly well that this might well be the moment, and certainly is, to address some of these in a vital way. I just also wanted to mention the Harvard connection and a correspondence I'd been having recently with William Polk, who was the founder of the center. He was at Harvard and came here in 1964, had a famous conference here in 1965 called The Beginnings of Modernization in the Middle East, produced a book called Polk and Chambers, which was a kind of Bible to us when we were trying to understand the economic history of the Middle East, and who is still alive, living in the south of France, which is a good place to be, and writing interesting articles about Syria. He left his directorship here after 2 years in Chicago and went to Washington, obviously drawn by the powerful world of Washington, and learned about weapons of mass destruction, so he tells me, which included, even in those distant days, weapons, chemical weapons, although they weren't the ones we thought about. And so that is a kind of Harvard Middle East connection that I like to revive and think about. Okay. So I want to begin, as I say, by saying that I think the revolution is all about politics in Egypt, a state that produced great excitement, great enthusiasm, and then went on to lead to great political polarization, as I'm sure anybody who knows about Egypt is familiar with, in which Egyptians are bad-mouthing each other and refusing to speak to each other and ascribing bad... Ah, I see an Egyptian lady in the audience. In a way that is quite shocking to any of us who know about Egypt. There used to be things called douches in Egypt where two cars would bump into each other and the drivers would get out and pretend to fight each other. And then the crowd would assemble and pull them apart. That was how Egyptians dealt with minor problems. Now the crowd would urge them to fight each other probably, or perhaps shoot each other. So it is a bad moment politically. But there are also reasons for hope, in that revolutions are moments when not only do people talk to each other, but they also discuss, they have very imaginative responses to political problems. I remember hearing a young Egyptian woman on the BBC talking about how what Egypt needed was a whole-scale reform of the education system, and a whole-scale reform of the legal system, and a whole-scale this, and a whole-scale that, all of which would take 50 years. But nevertheless, moments in which people do, there's a kind of break in traditional thinking. People think again, imagine, have come up with creative ideas and so on. So all these are carried by the notion of revolution. And then Egypt, and I shall elaborate on this in a moment, also has an extraordinary wealth of talent among Egyptian economists. There was one stage when in the IMF and the World Bank in Washington, the majority of experts about the non-European world were Egyptian. They were exiled Egyptian economists, including Ahmed Galal, the present prime minister, and many of my friends who were outside Egypt. And so you also paradoxically just have at the moment when you need it a wealth of well-trained economists. At the moment, within the bosom of the Sisi military dictatorship, but nevertheless, given some opportunity to think about the Egyptian economy and its longer-term prospects, and as I shall come to argue at the end, perhaps reviving the whole notion of planning, at least as far as part of the economy is concerned. In a way, the whole notion of Nasserite planning and so on and socialist planning was went with the Soviet Union, and then we have the free market and so on. So any notion of coming together in order to produce a stock-taking of resources and a plan about how you are going to address the long-term problems of the country were for a while on the back burner, but somehow in the midst of the revolution and the need for technocrats and the return of Egyptian economists is a cause for hope. And I was going to... remembering a talk which I had with an Egyptian friend of mine called Adel Gazarin, who was involved in trying to create a motor car industry in Egypt in the 1950s, who is now an old man in his 80s, who said that he was okay and so on, but he worried about his grandchildren, that the long-term worries about salination, drinking water, desertification, and so on were so great that he himself was okay, but he thought that his grandchildren were going to be in an Egypt which was even worse off than it seemed to be at the moment. And I suppose for many young Egyptians, the answer to that is to leave the country and seek a future elsewhere. All right, let me say something about the Egyptian economy. I always like French people who talk about a peur d'histoire at the beginning. You have to have a bit of history in order to get the context of the nation and its resources. And then I will say something about the uprising itself, the hopes, dreams, and possible realities, and then something about where I think, where we are now and what we should be thinking about if we're thinking seriously about the long-term future of the Egyptian economy. So everybody knows about the Nile and the Egyptian soil, which is the most fertile in all the world through the nutrients and through the Nile itself. And the fact that you've always been able to grow several crops a year in Egypt, and it should have been a market garden. This is something that Charles Essawi, the father of Middle East economic history, always argued, that Egypt should be a market garden, and to some extent it is a tiny bit at the moment. Roses are grown, which are sent to banks in Europe and so on. The question is how you best make use of the Egyptian economy. As it was, for historical reasons and under a powerful ruler called Mehmed Ali or Muhammad Ali at the beginning of the 19th century, it was decided to grow long staple cotton, which was a marvelous export crop, but not good for industrialization. The succeeding leaders of Egypt, all the way through to Nasser, used this extra long staple, the most beautiful cotton in the world. Anybody who knows about Egyptian cotton knows how silky it is. When the Queen came to the Queen of England, came to the ceremonies to mark the, whatever it was, 450th anniversary of the Jamestown settlement, it was announced by the hotel that she was sleeping between sheets of Egyptian cotton. So very valuable, should have been exported. They should have imported short staple cotton from India for the making pajamas for Egyptian gentlemen to laze around in. But there's always been a problem with Egyptian attempts to industrialization. There's always been a feeling that it should be based on this long staple cotton, which was a misuse of a national resource, and other things should have been done. There were also problems with the fact that Egyptian industrialization was also always based on an internal market. There wasn't much interest in the export of industrial goods. This led to the kind of crony capitalism that we associate with the Sadat and Mubarak period, when a few monopolists like Ahmed Ez and so on monopolized particular parts of the Egyptian economy. And this is, when that is backed with the monopolies of the military-industrial complex that began to be created in the 1970s, as a way of getting the Egyptian army to pay some of the costs of the huge pension schemes that involved in having such a large army. 450,000 men in the Egyptian army at the moment. And they all have pensions of a fashion, so a huge burden on the economy, which created another set of monopolies and another set of problems. And then we have a new set of dependencies that Egypt is involved in, developing the tourist industry, and then dependent on Europeans and subject at the moment from the depression in Europe, which means the number of European tourists going to Hurghada and the Red Sea and swimming above the coral reefs, anybody who's done that. Has anybody swum above the coral reefs in Hurghada? Anyway, one of the most magical things. And it's like swimming in a small aquarium of all the fish just under your... So, wonderful assets that Egypt has, but also problematic. And then finally, there is the fact that Egypt has always been, as part of the Arab world, which are the closest non-European neighbors, always interfered with in one way or another, exercised some form of colonialism, some kind of interference. And so this makes for a complicated and difficult economic history and a difficulty to imagine moments when Egyptian economists sit down and think about, this is our country, we've been living on the rents that we've been living on for a long time because we are the center of the Arab world. The Russians gave us money, the Soviets gave us money, the Americans gave us money, the Suez Canal is important, and all these kinds of things. Now we have a moment, and this is the good news about what I'm going to try and say, when it's possible, without over too much influence, for Egyptian economists to sit down, as I think they are doing, and saying, these are resources, these are what we're good at, this is what we should be doing, these are the problems, and devising a short-term and a long-term strategy for dealing with them. So part of the, this is the next point to make about the spring, is that it was a time for hoping and dreaming and imagining and thinking new thoughts and not getting stuck, which in the short run led to more problems, to elections, to a religious government, to anti-Morsi hysteria, to the Sisi coup. I had a good friend called Mustafa Nabli, who is a Tunisian economist who works for the who worked for the World Bank and the Fund, and I think may now have gone back to Tunisia to be an expert finance person in the new Tunisian cabinet, whose program for the Arab world when the uprising began was, you have a revolution, you have to have elections, you have to have a new constitution. I'm not quite sure why that is so, but it seemed to be, this is what happened in the Middle East, that the minute you have a revolution, you have to have a new constitution, you want a new political order, you have elections. The elections are inevitably won by religious parties like the Muslim Brothers, the Ikhwan, and the Nahda. They make a mess of things. Everybody turns against religious government, sense returns, and everybody lives happily ever after, which didn't quite happen as he had predicted, although things may be going better in Tunisia than in Egypt. On top of that, one also has political difficulties produce a reduction in tourism. You have a 50% drop in tourist income last year over this year because of the troubles. Nobody wants to go to Egypt. Few people go down the Nile, I think, protected from the fierce inhabitants of Egypt, but other people are afraid of going there, of difficulties and getting stuck at the airport and so on. You have a drop in the remittances that come from Egyptian workers in Saudi Arabia, and now you have even worse, the whole-scale expulsion of foreign workers from Saudi Arabia. I mean, quite extraordinary stories coming out of Riyadh and Saudi Arabia at the moment of a Saudi plan to Saudiize and so on, which has terrible effects on labor-exporting countries. Fred mentioned the thing I wrote about labor migration in the Gulf, and I think it was reckoned that there was something like, when I was writing in the 1980s, 3 million Egyptians outside their country, earning money which they couldn't possibly have done, and as you went up and down the Egyptian valley, you saw houses with red roofs, and we said infitar houses or remittance houses. But that is threatened. So the revolution itself came at a time of economic difficulty and in the short term has clearly accentuated the country's economic difficulties in various kinds of ways because of tourism and remittances and so on. So what is the good news? Well, we have all kinds of economists who seem to be in important parts of the Egyptian administration. A friend of mine, Hazim Beblawi, who is an oil economist, has been prime minister for a while. We have Ahmed Gamal, as I was saying. And we also have Gulf money that the Qataris and the Saudis have stepped into the breach in Egypt, where foreign money is threatened, American aid is threatened, to provide it with very large sums of money. And so we have the beginning of plans and programs for the Egyptian economy, and an opportunity with technical economists at the helm, with General Sisi, who is clearly a what would she say about General Sisi? Let us say he is a bad man. I won't try and elaborate on that. But at least he's sufficient of a Nasserite and remembering Nasserism that he may remember that there were plans in the Nasserite period. There were attempts at income redistribution. There was land reform in the Nasser period. That this might be a moment for planning, that he's not necessarily given to the market economists of the previous era, supported by the World Bank, when market forces were supposed to determine a country's future, and any notion of the state playing an important role was unwelcome. So we may be strangely at a turning point, as I'm coming back to this argument that I'm presenting, that out of the uprising and out of the thinking and out of political circumstances and out of one thing or another, one might be coming to a situation in which it is possible to imagine Egypt's real problems being addressed in a systematic and intelligent way, backed by money from the Gulf to provide the funds that are needed. So what are they? The big question is the $12 billion that Egypt gets under the Camp David agreement with Israel. Both Egypt and Israel get the same amount of money, $12 billion a year. And if that's in doubt, then there is a feeling that the Gulf states, and particularly the Saudis, will, in the interest of maintaining the Sisi government in power, will provide roughly that equivalent. So we have various plans and policies. For example, in September this year, a $4.2 billion program for economic development and social justice via labor-intensive public works projects, improvement in the business environment, the abolition of school fees. And I find it difficult to believe, but as argued by the Egyptian Prime Minister, the appointment of 80,000 new teachers and a rise in the minimum wage. So this is one way it's being addressed, not only in attempting to, in a kind of Keynesian way, in which you use money in bad times in order to generate work and income via various public works projects. So young Egyptians in the audience, it may be time to go home and be school teachers, although I don't suppose you will earn a great deal of money, but you will be performing a national duty to the young people who will presumably flock to the schools. If education is free, then there will be a large influence in the school-age population. They also attack the energy subsidy in a most interesting and imaginative way, with a smart card system Egyptians have cards which provide them with that they had cards before that provided them with subsidized a certain amount of subsidized food, up to a certain point. After that, they had to buy it at market prices, and also subsidized imports. The great problem in Egypt at the moment being the fact that fuel has been subsidized and is distorting the economy, particularly as Egypt is becoming a major energy producer from its oil and gas. And therefore, there's need for Egyptian energy prices to rise to world market prices, but there's also a need to protect the poor who are dependent on it in various kinds of ways. So there's also that. I mean, there is a question about the delivery of welfare in Egypt, which is complicated. I don't know this is whether there is a technological solution to this. When I lived in Egypt, nobody had an address. You know, if you asked somebody's address, it was go to the mosque, turn right and ask for Ahmed, and then three steps to the left and knock on a blue door or something or other. When there were censuses in Egypt in the period that I know about, censuses in 1907 and 1917, everybody had an address because the census people implied local people to give everybody a number. I mean, they'd name streets and they had numbers, and so every house was Egyptian had an individual address. Now I'm not so sure, but it may be that each Egyptian could be persuaded to have an email address, which might solve that problem. I'd be interested to hear from young Egyptians or anybody else who comes from country where it's difficult to target welfare because it's not clear how you get to poor people who don't have necessarily addresses and records and so on of that kind. There is an agreement with the international oil and gas companies. What I don't know is about the future of the agreement to provide cheap fuel to Israel, which was one of the corruption charges that was brought against President Mubarak and his son, that they were providing cheap, at lower than market prices to the Israelis down the pipeline that connects Egypt and Israel across the Sinai. But that's certainly, there's certainly an attempt to find a proper energy policy. And as I say, there is the possibility of a larger plan of having a 5-year plan and a 10-year plan in which you address in a longer term Egypt's basic problems, which are dire. As I say, there is everybody warned NASA that the Aswan Dam would lead to salination along the northern coast because the Nile no longer has the strength by the time it reaches Alexandria and, well, not Alexandria, but the two ports that at the northern end of the Mediterranean end of the Delta, to push back the salination. So salt water from the Mediterranean is creeping in. There's a huge problem of water all over the place, of proper drainage, of dealing with effluent of various kinds. And then there's the worry about the future of global warming and fewer rains and more dust storms and so on coming from the Sahara. So there are really long-term problems which have to be addressed. And also, while this is happening and while the economists are there, it's these same economists who are aware of the enormous administrative problems which anybody runs Egypt is concerned. For a long time, political scientists and people like me who are interested in government talked about the authoritarian system in Egypt, in which somebody like NASA had only to give an order and it was immediately followed right down the chain. It has never been like that, apparently. One of the things I heard from Hezim Beblawi when he went back to become prime minister was that there are 60 different budgets in Egypt. Each bit of the Egyptian government has its own budget. When I wrote about Lord Cromer, the British imperialist arriving in Egypt in 1883, he found everybody had their own budget, and he created a single Egyptian budget. And there probably was a time in the 1920s and 30s when there was a single Egyptian government, but now there are these separate administrative fiefs with separate budgets. So with the best will in the world, it's not entirely clear whether Egypt has the administrative structure at the moment, even with intelligent people in charge, in order to carry out the policies that I believe ought to be carried out. And then we have a very strange and ramshackle legal system and all kinds of things which also need to be involved. And we have another set of monopolies, which is the military-industrial complex, which it's not at all clear what part of the Egyptian industrial sector is controlled by the military, but it's thought to be somewhere between 20 and 40%. And here we have another unaccountable group of people who are producing all kinds of things and selling them to the Egyptian population, and no way of knowing whether this is cost effective, whether this is the kind of thing that Egypt ought to be producing in the first place. And so, as I say, with the best will in the world, it's still very complicated. And then you also have the fact that politics is still extremely polarized and so on. So where might there be good news in all this? Well, one of the bits of good news, I think, is that the engagement of various Arab diasporas in this revolutionary moment. As I was trying to say, my Egyptian students, everybody wanted to go to Tahrir. If you went in Tahrir, you would take you'd miss something important. I didn't go to Tahrir because of my bad leg, but I feel I'm not properly Egyptian because I wasn't present. When my student and friend Khalid Fahmy was in Tahrir with his father, I realized that things had changed. This is where you had to be. It does mean that there is an engagement of the possibility of engagement with Egyptians inside and outside, and a kind of expertise and a how to do it-ness which is available in the diaspora. And one of the stories I tell about the nuts and bolts of how people from abroad can help is the return of Rashid Ghannouchi and his daughter, the leader of the Nahda, who was in exile from Ben Ali for many, many years, somewhere near London Airport, sitting in silence because the British government had promised him, the Tunisian government, that if he was allowed to stay, he wouldn't talk politics. And Miss Ghannouchi seemed to have joined the local Labour Party. And she brought back to Tunisian politics Labour Party electoral practices, which I remember very well. Like, if you want old people like me with sticks to go to the poll, you send them cars. Or if you want to make sure that the opposition is not misbehaving in polling stations, you appoint poll watchers. So you have that transfer of nuts and bolts technology to the Middle East from the diaspora, which is available in Egypt and elsewhere, which I think is very important and should be a call to all the young Egyptians or young Tunisians or people in the audience that it is very easy to participate through the internet and in all kinds of ways and play your part in your country's difficulties. I have a dear friend, Mona Anis in Egypt, who is an old-fashioned Nasserite. Some of us remained true to the memory of Nasser into the 1980s until finally there was too much evidence of his dictatorial behavior. And then politics returned, and Mona was saying, well, they didn't know how to do the simplest things that you do in politics. They didn't know how to hire a hall. They didn't know how to have a meeting. They didn't know how to put up flyers and posters. You know, these things are just as important as somebody in Washington saying you must be democratic or something rather. The nuts and bolts of being democratic are something you have to learn, and they're best learnt by people who have engaged directly in the local bit of political processes abroad. So there is the possibility of the diaspora and this engagement. And there is something, too, that I've noticed among exiled Syrians and others whose countries, Middle East countries, Arab countries, are engaged in civil wars of one kind or another, that the civil wars don't spill over. During the Lebanese fighting in 75, 76, people were killing each other on the streets of Beirut, but Lebanese in London and New York were not killing each other. They were sustained by a kind of what in America is called patriotism. I used to call it patriotism before I came here, which is a love of country, which has a kind of unifying force. And I think love of country must include, in the case of Egypt, not just older civilization. It's better in Egypt, actually. It's all about the pyramids. Elsewhere, it's our girls are more beautiful than your girls. Our mountains are more beautiful than your mountains. We invented yogurt and all kinds of things of that kind, which goes on in less secure places like Syria and Iraq. But nevertheless, love of country and a desire for it to work and to people to appreciate it is a very important factor, which I think could be mobilized at the moment. So that's part of the now thing. And then let me just end on a positive, more positive moment and some ideas of my own, apart from the engagement of the diaspora. So we have a good moment in that I think there is space in Egypt for the first time without foreign influence, without people telling Egyptians what to do, to come together to work out what are their country's needs, what can be done, what ought to be done, without experts telling them what to do. In fact, although the Egyptian economists all work for the IMF in very large numbers and now, the one thing that Egypt will not tolerate is an official visit from the IMF saying, you must cut subsidies and do this, that, and the other. So that there is a kind of distinction there between the expertise that's available, but the desire to resist being told to from outside, by being told what to do. So you have a space in which to work out your plans, short-term, long-term, in terms of assets and resources. You again get the beginning of the possibility of the exploitation of geographies of scale at the eastern end of the Mediterranean, not the grand schemes for Arab economic unity or something of the Nasser period, which people immediately resented because everybody wanted protects their own sovereignty, but the sharing of electricity grids that goes east of Egypt. I think there's a Egypt's on the grid that connects Jordan and Syria and so on. There are gas grids, there are all kinds of tourism possibilities, there's the North African road, there are all kinds of ways in which Egyptians can get together with their neighbors in order to promote tourism, highways, grids, and so on. And then there is the very important possibility of exploring the European connection. And I think this needs to be done through the Barcelona process of 1995, with Egypt already has a treaty with the European Union. Because anything to do with Europe is not only good in that it gives you access to European markets, which, I mean, it's difficult. You have to argue well, but you nevertheless have to get access. There was one time when the only access Egypt seemed to have was potatoes. I remember Egyptian potatoes arriving in Oxford in February every year, covered in valuable Nile soil. I mean, that was a bad moment in Egyptian history when they were starting exporting their soil along with their potatoes. They should have kept the soil at home because it's so valuable. But that's the connection of Barcelona. And I think you can use the European thing as the Turkish progressive people did by saying, if we want to join the European Union in some kind of proper partnership capacity, we have to be democratic, because that is, we have to have human rights. We have to accept things that are acceptable to the Europeans. And although as we know, the Turks have not been allowed into Europe properly and may never be allowed into Europe, it was a very useful tool for progressive people to say, in order to be part of the European community and in order to have some chance of having closer political connection, we have to do these reforms and these reforms and these reforms. And there I'll end and solicit comments from you on what you think I've been saying and whether you have your own words to add about this as I say, paradoxical situation in Egypt where, I mean, there is the Sisi government, there is great division, but nevertheless, there are people in charge with some possibility to implement the kind of medium-term and long-term plans which the country desperately needs. Thank you.
So my question is, one of the advantages of a democratic government is that one has the legitimacy of implementing economic policies that might not be that might be problematic or that might be radical. So, what do you see? what is the likelihood of this happening in this situation, and isn't it maybe more likely for the current government to implement populist fixes that are actually not solving underlying economic problems?
Yes, I mean, there's always a balance, I think, between democracy and popularity and so on. I mean, there, you know, what the Morsi government, dependent on the ballot box, was prepared to do, I mean, leave aside whatever we may think about religion and politics and so on, was dependent on popular support. So you have to carry a democracy along. But as far as, I think one has to make a distinction in Egypt, which I was trying to make, between long-term planning, which does require some kind of authority and some kind of expertise and some kind of establishment of national aims. So that has to be done, and then that has to be popularized in some kind of way. Now, you might well argue that the Prime Minister and Hezim Beblawi and Galal and all these people, because they're not dependent on the ballot box, will not be so careful about popularity and so on, and will just go for planning and authoritarian planning in the Arab socialist way that the Nasser government does. But there is some evidence, I think, that they do, they're there because they... No, they're in this government. They're attacked by everybody. Anybody who works for the CC government is likely to get attacked. But nevertheless, they're there because they have the interests of the people of Egypt at heart. And I think they do realize that, you know, there is awful poverty in Egypt and it has to be alleviated. And these measures that they've taken, free education and appointment of school teachers and public works and minimum wage and so on, are some effort to do that without straining the national resources too much. But and then there are going to be elections in Egypt, after all, although we don't quite know who will stand. It's a big question whether Sisi will just allow various parties to appear or whether Sisi will revive the Hizbul Watani, the National Democratic Party, or whatever. We don't know. But there will be some notion of accountability at some stage.
To capital flows and foreign direct investment. With regard to the Egyptian economy, they need foreign direct investment. I think that's a key priority. But there also needs to be some restriction on capital flows, in order to accumulate sufficient reserves. How do you think the government plans to address foreign direct investment in their recent planning?
Well, I think there is some verbal attention paid to the need for a business-friendly environment and to meet some of the criticisms that are made of Egypt, that you don't have laws and you're not sure about the repatriation of profits. So that's complicated and to be done. What I did discover, though, was going back to the crony period, of the Mubarak period, and let's think of Mr. Ez, who had the monopoly of the production of steel, that there was a learning process, even inside the Quranic population, in which I suspect they sent their sons to Harvard Business School or somewhere like that, where Egypt was beginning to export steel rods for building to the rest of the Middle East. So, you know, there are places in which entrepreneurism and investment and a knowledge of the world are being developed, which can be quite important, I think. You know, the idea that you have to have a monopoly in Egypt and you just control the local market, and if you have a car import business, you get the government to say that only cars with catalytic converters of friendly and so on, and all the other cars can't be imported. I don't think those games are being played at the moment, and there is the beginning, as I say, of export, the notion that Egypt has a comparative advantage in doing certain kinds of things, including steel rods. I wouldn't have thought that, but you'd think the Chinese would be doing that, but Maybe the Chinese have priced themselves out of the market. One, you know, these are complicated.
Mm-hmm. Hello? Yeah, it's on.
Yes, hello.
Okay. I have a question about the transition from the Mubarak regime mm-hmm. through the revolution, Tahrir, and then the Morsi government, and now to the Sisi regime. Seems to me, little I know, under the Mubarak regime, you had the army had a tremendous grip on parts of the economy, apparently. Now, under Sisi, the army seems to again be sort of in the ascendant. Mm-hmm. So maybe much hasn't changed, actually, since the days of Mubarak. And so what do you think the chances are that the Sisi regime will actually be able to implement significant change in the economy?
Mm-hmm. Well, I would argue, I mean, the Sisi regime is in some ways obviously a horrible dictatorial regime, and when it comes to security and the archives and the inability to discover what happens to disappeared people and torture and so on and accountability, things are as they were, I'm afraid, since the Nasser period. I don't think that there has been a great deal of improvement. But nevertheless, there is sufficient, there are the economic experts in the government itself, and I think whatever one may think of Sisi and so on and those people, they do feel the need to have people we would recognize as economists and development economists managing the whole thing. I mean, maybe in the old-fashioned way, you can, you know, having experts means you can dismiss them when their plans don't work and you don't lose politically in that particular. I don't know how they think about that. But it does seem there are a remarkable number of good men in experts in positions of power in Egypt at the moment. Now, whether they could persuade the military to give up its industry is another matter. We are told, but it depends on who tells you, that not only does the army owns lots of land, lots of people make money out of the army, out of their military connections. When the colonels retire, they go into business and so on and so on. But the army is not one thing. There's tremendous discontent within the army about the way in which certain people use their military connections in order unfairly to make a great deal of money for themselves, and that the colonels complain that they're living in retirement and they have not much money at all and they don't have access to goods. So if you could play it properly, you could use, you might be able to find ways of doing things in the army. Of course, the big problem is whether you should get rid of compulsory military service. I mean, that ought to happen. On the other hand, as the army employs in a country with enormously high unemployment, so many people, it's difficult to know about that. There was a moment, which I value, in 1979, when, after the Camp David agreement, Sadat said, we must have the peace dividend. We don't have any enemies anymore. We're not going to fight Libya or be invaded by Sudan or anything. What is our army for? And he said we should have a very small army consisting of special forces who jump out of planes and work for the UN and do various things. But then, unfortunately, Mubarak came, and being a military person, he had to maintain this stupid army, which is there in the first place because of, you know, historical upsetness about Israel and 67 has no purpose at all. I did ask somebody called General Vincent Brooks, the head of CENTCOM, a very impressive American general came, and you don't often get an opportunity. I said, what is the point of the Egyptian army, General Brooks? And he said, the point of the Egyptian army is to guard the frontiers of Egypt from Qaeda, from drug smugglers, and from some other group of people. That was the point of the Egyptian army. You don't need 450,000 people to guard the Egyptian frontier. So that's a problem. But realism would dictate that at some stage it has to be reduced in size. It has apparently 500 tanks, the Egyptian army. I mean, it has more tanks than the whole of Latin America, none of which. And it's making tanks with the Americans, the Abrams tank. It's good for the American taxpayer, particularly if you come from a state where their arms export industry is good, but it's not good for Egypt. Somebody should do something about that. I write about it in Hayat from time to time, but a small voice in the wilderness. Anyway, anybody who is in a position, say to anybody in the Egyptian army, what is the point of this army?
Sure. Yes. Quick question about, you had mentioned in passing entrepreneurship, and I was my question is around, do you think the government will be able to do the necessary things in order to encourage some small business and entrepreneurs to seed up? Because that's some of the positive stories that we've been seeing, at least out of Egypt, at least in my own field, is tech entrepreneurship and some stories where, despite everything that's happening, despite all the dysfunction that's happening in the government, despite everything, they've been creating businesses and trying to create something for themselves. And a lot of that then is that the talent that's in Egypt in terms of the universities, the intellectual kind of capacity to develop new ideas is being harnessed in that way, in a small way right now. Do you see that blossoming in the future, or do you see the state-owned enterprises and this type of a way of operating taking dominance in the future?
Well, I mean, I'm frankly out of touch with all these kinds of things, but it seems to me that things are happening in the service industry. I mean, you just suddenly discover there are no children's bookshops or something rather. You look at other people's consumption patterns. And these are the kinds of things which I think you can rely on Egyptian entrepreneurs to do themselves. I mean, you would ideally want banks that were willing to give them credit. And, you know, in the old days, the banks just gave credit to the cronies. I have a friend called John Svakaniakis who worked for the Abbasids at one stage and was present when Mr. Abaza told a servant to go down to the bank and borrow £1 million Egyptian pounds. Just on the say-so of, you know, the bank gave it to him because he knew that Abaza Sr. was a friend of the president. You need small credit, but I don't really know what you need for these kinds of things. But you need to find a niche, just as people in America do. And in the high tech, you need to provide something that they were previously doing or didn't exist, which they can do better. And this is also involved with tourism and all kinds of things, new hotels, new this, new that. So I think, you know, it's small scale. I don't know that it makes sense, but I think this happens, that people do see niches and they do believe in business education, and they, you know, it's just not terribly well recorded. And I don't think the state needs. I don't. I think that can be taken care of. Hello. Yes.
So there are two things you mentioned that are pretty stable in the Egyptian economy that I'd like you to shed some light on. I find, although I am an educated person, when it comes to economics, every time I try to understand something and I ask an economist, they say, "Oh, it's too complicated." So I hope that you won't give me that answer. And the two stable aspects of the Egyptian economy that you mentioned are the agricultural land and the Nile. And unfortunately, in the last 10 years, both of those have come under threat. So as anybody who's visited Cairo sees the residential buildings that are going up on absolutely fertile agricultural land, and then the Nile recently with the Ethiopian dam issue. So it seems like those two stable aspects of the economy, even those, are now under threat. And I'd like to hear you tell me as an expert that, oh, don't worry, like some economists have, but I will sit down and brace myself for the worst.
No, well, I think as far as that, you're right about the Nile. And there was this terrible time going to Egypt in the 1970s when you saw Nile soil being turned into bricks, which were then built houses on agricultural land, and so the actual soil was disappearing. But the opposite to this is the expansion into the desert. And here, you know, Israelis always talked about making the desert bloom. I don't believe actually the Israelis were very good at making the desert bloom, but they are good at telling Egyptians, wise Egyptians who have esbas and farms and things, used to get hold of Israeli water engineers. And the drip irrigation and so on is important. And if you now look, if you fly out of Cairo Airport, up the desert road to Alexandria, you see all kinds of trees have suddenly appeared. I know a lot of Egyptian friends of mine who have market gardens. You know, they're discovering how to, and you recycle, you know, I think in Israel, every drop of water is recycled 10 times or something or other. No, that's California. Sorry, I'm thinking about, but anyway, I mean, you know, there are all kinds of new technologies, which means you're not confined to the Nile Valley. That's the good thing about that. The Ethiopian dam, I think, is just, that was whoever it was who was saying we're going to bomb the Ethiopian dam. Because the Egyptians control the IMF and the World Bank in terms of loans, I think they've always said, we'll never give a loan to the Ethiopians to build a barrage on their Nile, from which 90% of the water comes from. I hadn't realized that. Is it the Blue Nile that comes from Ethiopia and the White Nile comes from? Yeah. The Blue Nile has 90%. So if the Ethiopians did have a dam, that would be terribly important. And the Egyptians have always said, we'll bomb the dam. We don't know. I mean, it doesn't seem to me likely that that is a pressing problem at the moment, but it may be in the future.
I think in some ways my question is sort of related to the previous question. And it's about the sense of an Egyptian economic identity. I don't know if such a thing exists in Egypt these days, but do you foresee that the Sisi government has any plans to embrace or, in a way, create such identity?
Mm-hmm. I've been thinking about Egyptian identity and Sisi and so on. Egypt is very short on the language of patriotism. They may sing Biladi, my country, from time to time, although I don't think they do that. I think it's just taken, I mean, I would like Egyptians to stand up and talk, I mean, tell me about this. There isn't a natural language. They don't say we are the best or something like that. It's just taken for granted that it's the oldest country in the world. And it's amazing how many Egyptians know about Egypt. You know, you get taught the pharaohs, the mummies, the pyramids. I think they're taught in most American schools. It's just known that this is a very old country, I think, and that it's, you know, the Nile is the most extraordinary river, and everybody should go and see Egypt before they die. So Egyptian sort of rah-rah-ism about how great Egyptians are doesn't seem to be part of that particular deal. So I can't imagine Egyptians imagining that they're either better or worse economic actors. There was a time when they all talked about they're all peasants, Fallah. King Farouk said he was a peasant. You know, that's how you identified yourself. You were a son of the soil. You were somehow connected with tilling the earth, even if you were just told your gardener to do something or other. But it's an interesting question. It's not like other people. They don't go in for self-advertisement. They don't say their women are more beautiful and they're, you know, that they are. Falafel is nicer than everybody else's. I think everybody knows that Egyptian cooking is hopeless. And
their kushari is better than everyone else's. We have to say that. I think this will be the last question.
Thank you very much for an interesting talk. You mentioned foreign money, specifically the Qataris and the Saudis. The Qataris sank $8 billion into the Morsi government, and kind of sort of a misplaced attempt to prop them up.
Yes.
Could you speak maybe about the limits to, and now Egypt's paid it back. They just recently claimed we've given $2 billion back to Qatar. What are the limits and the ramifications of these relationships with the oil monarchies? Thank you.
Yes. I think that's extremely interesting, what's going on in the oil monarchies. I mean, it's clearly there is a huge debate going on in the Qatari royal family about what to do, and a feeling that they've overextended themselves and their profile is too high, and they're just asking for a new bin Laden to come and attack them or something or other. So the use of money in the Gulf itself is being called in question. On the other hand, the Saudis now, having invented this split between, well, they didn't invent it, but they've certainly exacerbated the split between the Sunnis and the Shiis, and they don't like the Muslim Brothers and all that kind of thing. The Saudis are willing to invest huge sums of money in Egypt at the moment, and they may be, you know, I don't know whether how Saudi money comes and whether what the strings attached are, but it seems to me, you know, it's a moment of rethink about all this, but I think that if the Saudis believe that the Sisi government is under any kind of threat, they will be prepared to give it lots of money without much strings. And I mean, the thing about the Qataris was they were beginning to say, we're not going to give money because Egypt doesn't have the capacity to absorb it. You know, the Ministry of Finance, how do we know that it's going to be spent? And that's a big question. I mean, this discovery that there were 60 budgets in Egypt that Hazem Bablawi discovered is quite shocking. And then the way Mubarak ran the Egyptian government, apparently, according to these friends of mine, is that he appointed people in charge of government ministries, which became rent-seeking things. He just said, you can be in charge of this ministry, but you pay for yourself. You know, we're not going to give you any money from the government. That was the Mubarak thing. So that's made the separation and the different budgets and the military even more complicated. So it is it's a technically ungovernable country. And therefore, giving money to it, you have to worry about, I imagine, how your money is going to be used and accounted for and so on. But somehow or other, I think Gulf money will keep coming because there's just so much of it.
I see we have one more petitioner. Will you take one more question?
Yes, sure.
Okay. This will be the last question.
Yes, thank you. I wanted to ask what you think about the refugee problem that Egypt is dealing with and that how that has an impact on the economy. For example, now you have huge numbers of Syrians who are, on the one hand, they are creating jobs by creating lots of businesses and bringing in money. But on the other hand, especially the poorer segment are taking a lot of jobs. And how do you think will that play out as Egypt tries to kind of get out of this dire economic strait?
Yes, I don't know the answer to that, and I haven't been in Cairo recently. I mean, of course, the first place you think of is poor Jordan, that is overwhelmed by refugees from all over the place, and how they're going to deal, even keep them alive through the winter, let alone educate them. And, of course, the whole idea about Syria is that they all go home, but it's looking less likely that they will go home. So I just don't know. I mean, the whole business of the movement of people and refugees and staying in hotels and pensions and who does what, of course, they're different kinds. The richer people can come with suitcases and hope to sit it out and have relatives or find their way to Europe and so on. No, it's a kind of expert thing. I mean, it's never as bad as you would think it would be, but people are more resilient. But on the other hand, it is obviously a tremendous strain on resources and how people get around these days. In the old days, Egypt was insulated from refugees by the Sinai. And that's why so few Palestinians got into Egypt, because they couldn't. They could get to Beirut or to Amman, but they couldn't get to Cairo across the Sinai. But now, I don't know how the refugees come. I mean, some come across the Sinai, but some come by air, by boat, by bus, by whatever. And so you have more control of numbers. And I don't suppose many people just show up in Egypt. I mean, they do have border patrols, Apache helicopters. There is the Suez Canal. So I don't know, having said all that.
Thank you.
Well, let me close by thanking Professor Owen for his wonderful presentation, and thank you all for coming. Please join me in thanking him for being here.
Thank you.